Oh, that's right. Good afternoon, everybody. How you doing this afternoon? Hey, I'm Ann Eller, and I have Tim Lowry here. He is being sponsored by the Humanities Council of South Carolina. But before I introduce him, I've been given three possible introductions to give. It says the first one is a very short introduction. It says he tells stories of the people, by the people, and for the people. And it says, he's got in parentheses, I like this one the best. Then he's got the medium introduction that goes on and tells that he was a featured performer at the National Storytelling Festival, the South Carolina Story Fest, the North Carolina Storytelling Festival. He, needless to say, tells a lot of stories. And then if you go on to the long one, he says, please don't bore people with this blah, blah, blah. And that's why I had to introduce that one into it. He says he tells the stories by the people for the people. He mixes stories of American history and folklore with tales of growing up Baptist, teaching English to Russian immigrants, exciting road trips to Disney World, baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. Personally, Tim, I like that one the best, the verse part. I don't know about the rest of it, but the first part is pretty awesome there.
Yeah, the baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet definitely lets you know the era that I grew up in.
That's right.
Young school children really don't know what that is, but folks from a certain era can sing the jingle.
That's right, that's right. And some people may not know what a Chevrolet is either today.
Well, that part I'm kind of stretching a little bit. We never owned a Chevy. We had a Ford Pinto station wagon. But it just doesn't flow to say baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and a Ford Pinto station wagon.
It does not. It does not. So you've been touring schools and whatnot today for Greenwood Reads. How's that been?
Been great. Lots of receptive audiences all across the county. I was at Greenwood High School and 96 High School. And this afternoon I was at Ware Shoals Elementary School and had great audiences all three places.
Now, you're here because of the book?
I am here because of the book Cast Two Shadows by Anne Rinaldi, which was the junior novel or young reader's choice for Greenwood Reads.
Mm-hmm.
And so my specialty is American history and American folklore, and consequently I was here to talk about that book and stories that are related to the themes in that book.
Now, I would be interested because history can be so dry, and people can say, oh, bah humbug history, why do we need to know it? Why should we know it? What have you found with the students today?
There might have been a little bit of preconceived notion that history is a little dry, and maybe that storytelling was for little kids.
Right.
Because okay. They've all known storytelling from when they were for children. But when you begin to see that storytelling and history mm-hmm. are both just stories of human experience, humans mm-hmm. are fascinating.
Yes, they
just
can
go
be
and
very...
sit on a bench in the mall and watch. So it doesn't take long before things start to loosen up and they realize, oh, I see where this is going. This is going to be a little different from what maybe I anticipated.
You know, I think the human experience, all you need to do is go to Facebook and you can learn a whole lot about people, more sometimes than you'd really rather know.
This is true.
So that's why I was interested to see how the students were reacting to this. But on as far as the book, what parts of it, did you take any parts from that or how did you work it into today's?
When I read the book, you can see right away that Rinaldi she has her reader in mind all the time, and particularly a teen reader. So the book has a historic setting mm-hmm. and definitely has a historical, political background that is the setting for the story. But what really drives the story forward is a much more universal experience of family, of relationships that are built and then through circumstances broken and then have to be rebuilt. And so I concentrated more on those themes rather than on historic facts and figures and time periods and that kind of thing. So we looked at the human aspects of the story maybe more so than just the historic facts that are incorporated in the story.
Very, very interesting. Well, you know, I would be interested to know, what made you decide to become a storyteller?
I always loved storytelling. When I was in high school, I would enter storytelling contests. I was a speech and drama student in high school, and there was the yearly speech and drama tournament, and I would enter duet acting and dramatic monologue competitions. But storytelling was the one that I really would spend my most time on, really loved storytelling. And I thought that was a fun hobby,
right?
And I wanted to major in storytelling in college, or major in theater in college, and took an elective class in storytelling, and realized my skill set was much more suited to storytelling than it was theater. So I tell kids, I say, the main purpose of college is to teach you what you're not good at.
Well, there you go.
So I learned that I was not a good actor, but I was a good storyteller.
Sure. But you didn't start out in doing the storytelling. When you graduated, you became an English teacher. Is that right?
I was an English teacher. I did a little bit of storytelling and then left that for a regular everyday job in the classroom, and did that for 5 years, and had just gotten my feet wet as a storyteller and was really itching to go back to it.
Mm-hmm.
So my wife and I had, as you say when you're raised Baptist, a come to Jesus meeting, and
yes,
decided, let's just go for it. And that was 15 years ago, and we haven't looked back.
Wow. Now, what does your wife do?
She's a stay-at-home mom.
Okay.
And before our children came along, she was a music teacher. She taught general music and also strings.
Wow. So she's an artsy person, too.
Yes.
Yes. So yes, that's how that come-to-Jesus moment could happen here. Yes.
That's true. We understand each other.
Exactly. Yeah. That's what I was thinking. All right. Well, we are here with Tim Lowry. He is, as I said, being sponsored by the Humanities Council of South Carolina. We do have Prudence here with us. She's been traveling around showing Tim where to go and have a good time. And she's going to be here in the video. You'll see her. She said she was going to be quiet today, which is going to be hard for Prudence, but we'll let her slide as long as she can. And then we're here with Tim. But right now, let's hear a quick word from our sponsors, and we'll be right back.
Gold. Gold. More precious than any other time in history. Do you have gold? Do you need cash? Then bring it to SFG. That's Sharp Facets Gallery, 1220 Bypass 72, Greenwood. Telephone 229-6613. Don't forget, we buy diamonds too. Paying the highest prices for your gold and diamonds at Sharp Facets Gallery.
Oh, that's right. We're rocking right here, Sharp Facets Gallery, this afternoon. Sure hope you are going to have the opportunity. Tomorrow morning, he is going to be at the Ware Shoals Community Library on Thursday at 10 a.m., and that's going to be one of his final performances at the part of the Greenwood Reeds. So we're going to talk more with Tim Lowry this afternoon. If you'd like to see that, you just need to be at the Ware Shoals Community Library on Thursday. That is tomorrow, October 30th. So you like history. You've come up with, have you developed some personas in your storytelling? Or what exactly, how do you go about this?
Yes and no. I experimented with playing historical characters, but that can be very, very tricky. There's always somebody in the audience who wants to play Stump Thomas Jefferson.
Right, yeah, there you go, yeah.
And so that can be really tricky.
You're setting yourself up for failure.
Sure,
there. Yes.
Sure. And then oftentimes I'm not in a setting where everything is conducive to pulling that off. I tell school kids, I say, it's very hard to have an interview with George Washington, and all of a sudden an intercom comes on and somebody says, can you send James to the office for his vitamin shot? So I kind of backed away from that after I saw where I would be working and how things would work out for me. But occasionally I do don a costume because I was a theater major, so I still love to dress up. And really just play myself, but use the costume as a way to kind of set a mood or create a feeling to help people know where this is going or what our subject will be. I love colonial costume because it's just so grand.
Yes.
And very flashy. But
does it help you get into character? Does it help you get into character?
Definitely, it does. Yes, definitely. There's a reason people in those portraits are ramrod straight, because when you wear that clothing, you cannot slouch. You just can't. It's just not physically possible.
Now, you were telling us a story before you came on the air about being, I think it was in Washington, D.C., were you, with mm-hmm. your garb and everything, and you had a hat.
Oh, yes, yes. I try to travel with just a carry-on, because mm-hmm. then you can get on and off the plane quickly and easily. But this time I was taking my whole big colonial rig to a house concert in Maryland, just north of Washington, D.C. So I had a colonial coat that weighs 7 pounds, and knee breeches and stockings, and the shirt with the lace and the ruffles and all of that, all packed in a suitcase. And then I have this big tricorn hat with the ostrich plume. That you can't put in the luggage because it'll get crushed. So
correct.
There's nothing to do but wear it, particularly when you go through security and they want to look in every nook and cranny of that hat. So
is that all the nook and crannies they wanted to look in?
When you, yeah, yeah. Apparently, I don't fit a profile, so they let me through. Just wanted to check out the hat, but it would either lead to a very fun conversation. People would say, "Tell me about your hat," or "I like your hat." Or because I was headed to Washington D.C., a lot of people would assume that I'd bought it at a museum, and they would say, "Where can I get a hat like that?" I'd say, "Oh no, this one I came from home," or they would be absolutely scared to death, and they would look and then quickly look away like you had some hideous deformity or something.
Some disease, yes. There you go. So what happened, though, when you were at the, you were getting ready to leave, you had some extra money left on a Metro card.
I did. Yeah, I had a Metro card with about $5 left on it. And so I'm on my way out of the Metro station. I see people over at the machines buying Metro cards, and I thought, oh, I should help somebody out. So I walked up to a businessman in his suit and his briefcase. And I said, I have $5 left on this Metro card. Would you like to use it? And he backed away and looked really nervous. He said, no, no, no. Not even no thank you. Just no, no, no. And
back then away from me. Back away from me, strange man.
I had forgotten that I had that hat on my head.
Right.
So then the next person I met was a teenage girl. And I said, would you like this Metro card? It has $5 on it. It might save you some money. And she said, sure. Cool hat, man.
Just shows you the difference, doesn't it? That's great. That's great. You have to have a lot of interesting experiences on this journey you've been on.
I do.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always, people have always fascinated me, and I tend to, oddly enough, sometimes you can be a little shy, but I remember, oh no, there's a treasure to be found here. So put yourself out there and meet people and talk to them, and you'll find an interesting story.
Yes, I think I have spent quite a few hours talking with Jane Herlong, who was a former Miss America contestant and also is a storyteller of sorts. She says she loves traveling on the planes because people will tell you things they would never tell anybody that they actually knew.
It's true. I'm sure that is very true.
And one of her quotes that I really love, she said, you know, Ann, there's a little bit of honey boo-boo in everybody. And I think she's right. Now, unfortunately, that quote probably is not as good as it was 6 months ago, but still, I like that. So why do you write down that you taught growing up Baptist, teaching English to Russian immigrants? I'm fascinated with that. How did that come about?
Well, there are many stories from those 5 years that I taught English to Russian immigrants. And
how did
we talked today about the intersection of cultures, and that was very much an intersection of culture. My wife and I volunteered at the public library to teach an ESL class. It was really just a favor to a friend, and we thought, oh, we're awfully busy. We'll do this until you can get somebody else. And when we went to our first class meeting, we expected to have a large Hispanic population, maybe a few Asian people. And as it turned out, we had all Russian senior citizens. There were a dozen students. Our youngest was 69 years old, and our oldest was 85.
Oh, my God.
And we very quickly inherited a dozen Russian grandmas and grandpas, as they taught us to say, our babushkas and dedushkas. And we became fast friends and had so much fun. Every Sunday afternoon, without fail, we would meet at the library and practice conversational English for their new life when they had immigrated to the United States.
Now, how did they get to come to the United States? That's pretty unusual to have that large a group in one place.
It's true. And I don't know that I ever heard how they ended up in Charleston, South Carolina. But many of them had a similar story in that they had children who were young professional people in Russia, and as soon as the Iron Curtain came down and they were able to come to the United States, they quickly came to the United States and would work very hard and save money and then bring their aged parents to the U.S. where they could have a much better life and better opportunity.
So, but they had no knowledge, really, of America.
Not really. In fact, one of the fun conversations we had is I said, tell me what... I said, our impression growing up in the Cold War was that Russians were stern, a little bit dangerous, never to be trusted. I said, and it turns out you're very warm, very gregarious, very happy, jolly souls. And I said, what was your impression of America? And they said, oh, we know America very happy because of Glenn Miller. And they loved Glenn Miller's music because they knew it from World War II days when the Russians were allies of the Americans, and they could sing you every Glenn Miller tune that had ever been written.
In English?
Well, yeah, or just the tune, you know, they could hum all the tunes.
Okay.
Yeah.
Wow, how about that? Well, that had to be a great, I bet you've got a lot of good stories to share on that.
It was a lot of fun. In the school programs that I did today, we were talking about intersection of culture, and we spent a good bit of time talking about the Gullah culture, which figures prominently in the book Cast Two Shadows. And I, for a period of time while I was teaching English as a second language as a volunteer, I was also a fifth grade regular classroom teacher. And I had a little boy who came from the Gullah culture, spoke a lot of Gullah at home. And he would, when he got under pressure at school, if he hadn't done his homework or if he didn't know the answer to a question, when he would feel the pressure, he would revert to Gullah and he would say things in Gullah. And he ended up being pen pals with my Russian students. And that was like Gorbachev meets Gullah. That was a very interesting cultural exchange.
I'll bet so. You know, it is interesting that the easier it is actually to intersect cultures today, do you think we do it as much as you would expect, or are we trying to maintain the separateness of the cultures?
I think it depends. In some places, things are much more mixed, much, much more comfortable than they were a generation or two ago. And then in other respects, there's a lot of separation still. Some of that has to do with socioeconomic boundaries. Some of it, I think, cultural distinctives are not a bad thing.
Right.
And some of it, I think, just falls down to personal preference.
Sure.
For instance, I'm a Presbyterian. I like Presbyterian take on theology. However, the worship style is kind of strains me a little bit.
Okay.
It's
right.
Very stiff and straight.
Right.
Yeah.
Yes.
If I had my will.
It has tradition.
Yes.
Okay.
But if I had my will, I'd have Presbyterian doctrine in a Black Baptist church because I really like their worship style.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's probably not likely going to happen. We just are happy on two sides of the theological street for a while.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that I am, we're probably going to have to maybe pick this up after or just do a quick answer on this one. You know, one of the things that it seems like to me, though, is that we are losing somewhat of our Americanism. People don't seem to want to melt into to becoming Americans. We seem to have separate cultures very much more than we used to.
I think generationally that is definitely a big change. My Russians were very keen on being as American as possible.
Okay.
And it seems like younger immigrants are not necessarily on the same page where that's concerned. That would just be my observation from my own personal experience.
All right. Well, that sounds great. Hey, tell you what, we are right here with Tim Lowry. He is with the library with Greenwood Reads. Right now, we are going to hear South Carolina news and a word from our sponsors. If you've got a question for us, give us a call, 229-7984. That's 229-7984. News is up.
McDonald's presents Confessions of an Ex-Hipster.
I loved cappuccinos, so I put on an itchy turtleneck and grew a goatee. But before I knew it, I was into French films, indie rock, and not bathing. Luckily, I got help from McDonald's McCafe cappuccinos. Now I'm watching football, wearing khakis, even high-fiving again. Thank you, McDonald's.
New McCafe mochas, lattes, and cappuccinos from McDonald's. With fresh ground espresso and real steamed milk, it's all the coffee, hold the attitude. At participating McDonald's.
Visit your local McDonald's in Greenwood and Abbeville today.
Oh, that's right. We're right back with you right here. We've been telling, you know, when storytellers get together, I guess you could say first liar doesn't stand a chance, couldn't you, Tim?
That's true. That's a very good way to say it. The first liar doesn't stand a chance.
Exactly. I'm sitting right here with Tim Lowry. He is a storyteller extraordinaire. His website, StorytellerTimLowry.com, that's Lowry, and he is being sponsored by the South Carolina Humanities Council, so he's here as part of Greenwood Reads. We got to say a big shout-out to Prudence for putting this all together. It takes a lot to bring this all together, but I've heard a lot of good things this time about Greenwood Reads there, Prudence, so congratulations.
Great, thank you.
So this is the wind-up, this is the end, and we're glad to have Tim here with us. But, Tim, you know, we've been talking about culture, we're talking about today versus many years ago. I happen to be looking at your award here, one of the awards you just won, Stay on the Road. Now, what's that kind of award is that? Stay on the Road.
Well, Stay on the Road is the title of a CD.
Oh, okay.
Yes, and it was awarded a medal from Storytelling World magazine.
Okay.
For recording storytelling excellence. And it's a story, it's the title story on the CD. When I first started to work as a storyteller and folklorist, I was a carriage driver in the historic district in Charleston, South Carolina.
Now, that's an interesting way to get people to hear you.
Oh, yeah. Yeah,
yeah,
you have
exactly.
A captive audience, and you learn lots of stories, lots of history, lots of folklore. And I joke and say, and sometimes when you get in a jam, you just make stuff up, so you get lots of experience as a storyteller. And there was a day when I was feeling very homesick, and so I'd stopped by a local church that was having a revival service, and I was standing outside and listening to the singing. And a lady invited me into the church. And because I was homesick, I decided, I'll go. I'm going to go in. And did not think about the cultural implications. I was wearing my Confederate uniform that I used to drive the carriages with. And I stepped into a historic black church in the middle of a revival service wearing my Confederate uniform.
Stand out at all, did you?
Not a bit. And I met a very warm, kind group of people with an excellent sense of humor, and they saw that as a very funny thing and welcomed me and introduced me to the Gullah culture, which I came to love and have the great opportunity and great privilege of representing as a folklorist when I'm at storytelling festivals and cultural events all across the country.
Wow, good story. Yeah, so that's how you honed your craft then.
Yes, I got lots of good experience as a carriage driver. Carriage drivers have a real catbird seat as a folklorist. It's your job to know about not only the history of the town, but there's often questions from people visiting Charleston about who owns this home currently and what kind of business are they in. So you learn about all the high society of Charleston, but you work on the street. So you also learn about anything that's going on street level. You know, we knew all the scandal, we knew all where the cops were hanging out and where things were going down because we worked on the street.
Exactly. You know, that would bring an interesting question. You know, there's been so much discussion about in New York City about doing away with the carriages. You know, from your perspective as a carriage driver, what do you think about that?
You have to strike a balance with that kind of thing. New York is very much like Charleston in the respect that people have always lived there.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Colonial Williamsburg, you have a town that was recreated as a museum for visitors.
Sure.
So you can control all that very easily. But New York and Charleston, you have livability issues.
Sure.
So people's safety and traffic flow and that kind of thing have to be considered. And so I think you have to find a balance. I have not spent time in New York City. It's hard for me to imagine, and I can only use my imagination, but it's hard for me to imagine horses working in that fast-paced atmosphere. Charleston is a slower pace, so I think it fits better in Charleston.
Okay. All right, but I often wonder about that because that is such an integral part of New York City.
There's plenty of movies that portray, you know, a romantic carriage ride in Central Park and that kind of thing.
Yeah, so that's why I was curious, since you've been in the biz
Mm-hmm.
There, okay. All right. Well, when we talk about what you do, it looks like you're very busy. Looks like you are on the road a lot.
I am on the road a good bit. Yeah. And grateful for it. People say, never complain about being busy.
That's true.
And people say, do you have a story about fill in the blank? And I say, how much time do I have? Oh, we need you in 4 weeks. In 4 weeks, I'll have a story about that.
That's great. But, you know, I'm curious, what made you decide to, you had a good job as a teacher. How did you decide to jump off and give that up and become a storyteller?
I had just gotten my feet wet as a storyteller. I was working as a carriage driver. I applied to the South Carolina Artist Commission artist roster so that schools and other nonprofit agencies could write grants, and then they would receive funds to hire me to come to their school. And had done a little bit of that work. And then Newt Gingrich, remember him?
Remember that fellow named Newt Gingrich? Yeah.
Was elected to Congress with his contract with America. And part of all that political discussion was that the National Endowment for the Arts would be done away with. That would be eliminated. And not only me, but lots of artists kind of panicked and thought, oh, we better go get a real job.
Right.
So I left storytelling and went to the classroom and taught for 5 years.
Newt Gingrich's fault.
That was what it was. But I'm a big believer in Providence. There are forces at work much larger than Newt Gingrich. Thanks be to God.
Yes.
So 5 years of classroom experience served me so well because I work in schools very often and I know the ropes. Mm-hmm. And so then I was really itching to go back to my first love, which was storytelling. And by that time, the contract with America was kind of a moot point, and the National Endowment was going on strong. But what I learned even more importantly was that if that's really what I meant to do, I don't even need a National Endowment for the Arts to do that. You know, things will fall into place. So,
it still took a leap of faith from a steady paycheck to who knows.
A little bit scary. Because I was a five-year career teacher, I was a shoo-in for substitution.
Okay.
Because, you know, you can have a volunteer who has very little classroom experience or somebody who has 5 years experience, a teaching certificate. I knew how to crack the whip and hold the chair. So anytime I had a hole in my schedule, I could always substitute teach. And that's how I filled my schedule the first year. And then after that, I didn't have to do that anymore. I've been full-time storyteller ever since.
That's pretty awesome. That's pretty awesome.
Yeah, as my dear Russian friends would say, only in America.
Only in America. There you go. But I would be curious, what did your mom and dad think about you taking off as a storyteller?
I joke and say, when I told my mom, I'm going to quit my job and become a storyteller, she said, would you like fries with that? But actually, that's a little storyteller's license. They were very supportive and thought it was a good idea and thought that I could make a go of it. So I had lots of good support in that respect. Now, I had a good friend who was scared to death that I was going to starve. And he even put me in his car and drove me around to all the schools in his school district and personally introduced me to each principal and practically begged them to hire me because he was afraid I would starve. But it wasn't that bad.
That's terrific. Hey, I tell you what, we are here with Tim Lowry. We're going to be back in just a moment. Don't you go away.
Layaway. We've done it for over 30 years here at Sharp Facets Gallery. So whether it's Christmas, a birthday, an anniversary, or just because, we know layaway every day. Come see us today at Sharp Facets Gallery. Need more info? Call us 229-6613. That's 229-6613.
Oh, that's right. We're right back here, Sharp Facets Gallery. We are talking with Tim Lowry. You know, he has been in the schools all day today. If you have school-age children, you may find that they'd be interested to talk about that tonight at dinner time. So take some time to ask them what they did. But also, he's been brought here by the Humanities Council of South Carolina. So kudos to the Humanities Council for bringing an excellent storyteller to us. You know, Tim, one of the things that I think about is that storytelling, is it a dying art?
Oh, I wouldn't say it's dying.
Final breath?
It ebbs and flows, but it's still here. I think we'll see a pendulum swing.
Okay.
People will will get up to the eyeballs in social media and realize, I haven't had human touch. And so then things start to swing back the other way. I don't think it's going anywhere. It just might be closeted a little bit sometimes and in some places. But now, as long as there's two people on the earth, there will be storytelling. Yeah. I say it's the oldest art form. When Eve said, he made me do it, storytelling began.
That's where it began. You know, one of my favorite movies, and I cannot think of the name of it right now, Mel Gibson and, if Jeff was right here, he could tell me the name of it. But the bottom line is, there was a group of children that lived, this was in Australia, that lived in the bush. And the only way they could keep their history alive was to do the tell. And mm-hmm. the tell was telling the stories of their culture. And, you know, when we think about history and storytelling, it's been here, as you said, since Adam and Eve. But that's how things, until we were able to actually write it down and come up with a language.
Oh, yes. Very much so. I have a colleague who does the Book of Genesis mm-hmm. as a one-man show. Okay. And when you see him recite Genesis, you realize, oh, for generations, that's how this story went. It was just, you asked the old guy, and he knew all the stuff.
Exactly. And so that's how they passed it on, because we have to continue to tell the story, and that's what they would tell the little kids. You've got to be able to continue to, Mad Max, I think mm-hmm. that was, but it's just a crazy movie. It's got Tina Turner in it, you know, but it is just so fun. But that part always impresses me, because they talk about, oh, we've got to tell the story. It's the tell. We got to do the tell.
Yeah, yeah. And in American culture, from my perspective, I think Southerners still have that in their bones. They want to remember the old stories.
Yes.
And they see the importance of that.
Yes, I think you're right. And, you know, the very fact that South Carolina is steeped in so much history with the Revolution. And, you know, I know you probably haven't had a chance, but over there in 96, we have the 96 National Battlefield Park over there.
Oh, yes, indeed.
And there is so much history in our area. And I really think that it really connects us and ties us together.
Mm-hmm.
It does.
I agree.
So do you make up your own stories as you go along?
Sometimes, not quite as I go along, but there's definitely adjustment depending on how the audience is responding and that type of thing. Stories from history are researched and you pull from a variety of resources, and then sometimes to fill in a gap you might have to use an educated imagination. And then stories of personal experience are often, it's all true, but you craft it so that it'll be fun for the listener. I do have colleagues who literally make stuff up on the fly. It's improvisational storytelling, which I'm not quite that brave. I want a safety net of some rehearsal.
Well, actually, you know, when you think about, you know, tragically Robin Williams, but as being able to tell a story and just, did he go off on
and
a tangent?
And just roll.
Right.
Yeah, just roll. Yeah, and there's a little bit of that, I think, in every storyteller. Yeah, particularly when you're playing off audience reaction.
Yeah. How important is the audience reaction?
Oh, that's very important. Storytelling is, I say, it's like a partnership, and we're sculpting in smoke. What we create will only last for a short time, and then it'll dissipate. And we will have the memory of it, but we won't have that thing that our imaginations made together ever again. And that's why you have to tell the story again, because then we're going to come together and create this new thing that's similar to what was, but is yet unique in its own creation. And that dissipates. And so we do that over and over and over again. I think people do that in their families. They do that in their communities. And we do that as a society.
Oh, sure. There's always a story that you ask somebody to tell. Oh, you got to tell them the story about, right?
Oh,
you
yes. know?
And then it's always fun, because I always do that to Jeff. And then I'm always helping him. No, you forgot this part, right? You
know? Oh, sure.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, that's the sculpting.
Yeah, exactly. Well, listen, we wanted to ask you to tell us, and since it's right here at Halloween, I thought maybe a good ghost story would be something you could share with us, Tim.
Oh, yes. There are plenty of ghost stories that I think are just a good story. But this one in particular has always resonated with me and speaks to that idea of why we must tell the stories. Don't look. If you're laying in your bed at night and you hear the rumble of wagon wheels and the clatter of horses' hooves, don't look. Don't get up to see who's going by your door. If you hear a sergeant yelling, "Step up there, get in line," you hear the heavy tramp, tramp, tramp of boots in the street, you just lay still in your bed. You hear horses clip-clopping down the road, you hear the heavy caisson that carry the great cannon, you just lay still. Everybody knows what that is. That's the sound of the marching dead. Civil War soldiers who were killed and buried in the fields and the valleys wherever they fell, and the last thing they heard was that General Lee needed reinforcements for more fighting in Virginia. And so you never can tell when, sometimes at the dark of the moon, sometimes at the bright full moon. It's completely unpredictable. But you might, in a quiet night, hear them muster a ghostly army and rise up from their graves and go marching northward toward Virginia. And if you hear them passing by your door, you never look. Those are the Confederate fallen. They only stir because they want you to know they are there. So as long as you sing the old songs and tell the old tales, they realize that they're not forgotten and they can rest in their graves. But should you stop singing and stop telling, don't be the least bit surprised if they rise up from their graves and you hear them marching past your door. But if you hear them marching past the door, don't look.
Bravo. Yes, there you go. Don't look. Yes, we all can think of very many times where there's something where it's best not to look. Well, you know, I think this has been terrific to have you here. I think you also have a website.
I do.
Mm-hmm. What is the website?
Yep, StorytellerTimLowry.com. Feel free to log on. You can download the story of the month.
Story of the month. Do you come up with a new one every month?
A new one every month. So you have to go and get your ghost story now, and then we'll have a new story come November 1st.
Wow. Okay. And so one of the other things I wanted to ask you, we're kind of running out of time, but it says your personal interests: marionette puppetry, Southern writers, barbecue, Christmas, and operas.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an eclectic group of things.
Oh, yes,
there.
And the opera is what I'm most excited about tonight because it's the seventh game of the World Series, and one of my favorite opera singers, Joyce DiDonato, is scheduled to sing the Star-Spangled Banner.
Oh, my God, and I didn't know this.
Baseball and opera, what's not to like?
That's right. Now if we just throw in a Chevrolet here and some apple pie, you'll be in heaven. So, marionette puppetry. What do you do with that?
It was my first introduction to performing arts when I was a little boy. My mom and dad took me to see a marionette show, and I was absolutely enthralled. So I collected marionettes as a child, and my first business was called Timmy and Friends Marionette Theater, and I would play your birthday party for $15. And now I have all those marionettes at home, and they come out every Christmas Eve, and I do a puppet show for my own kids.
That's terrific. I had Dorothy in The Wizard of Oz. She was a marionette puppet, and had her, and I just worked forever, and finally I said, no, I can't do this. I'm just a talker. Well, Tim, where do you go next? After tomorrow. Tomorrow he will be over there at the Ware Shoals Library, 10 o'clock.
Yes, at Ware Shoals, and then I'm going to go home.
Go home.
And I'm going to trick-or-treat with the kids on Friday night. And sometimes I set up on my front porch and tell spook stories to the trick-or-treaters, but this time I'm just going to go around the neighborhood with the kids and take the night off and eat candy. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. And November is kind of quiet. I'll be in the upstate again toward the end of November for a colonial day at Calhoun Academy over in Anderson County.
Okay.
And between here and there, I don't know. You just never know what's coming up. I'm always telling stories in Somerville, my hometown, which is birthplace of sweet tea.
Yes.
So third weekend of every month, we have Storied Somerville, and I do programming at the historic Timrod Library and on the trolley, Eats on the Sweet Tea Trail trolley tour. Yes, that's lots of fun.
You want to say that again for us?
Good Eats on the Sweet Tea Trail. Right. So we eat our way through history. I take you through the historic district, and we hit up 8 or 9 local restaurants and have a tasting sample as we go.
Oh, that sounds like fun.
Lots of fun.
Absolutely. Well, Tim, it certainly has been a delight to have you here. So glad you made it up here to Greenwood. Prudence, thank you for bringing him here today. And this is WCRS right here in Greenwood. Thanks again, Tim Lowry.
My pleasure.
All right. Bye-bye, everybody.